Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career and advice for other veterans. Today is episode number 111 with Chris and John Boigiano.
Wouldn't it be great if our country didn't have to care about Iraq's oil or the Middle East's oil? Maybe we should start an energy-related business. Okay, let's go figure that out. And that was roughly the thought process that kind of gave us the left and right limits of let's start an energy business. And then we just explored a million different, as John said before, the idea of the week, we just endlessly turned over, rock after rock after rock trying to find something. Absolutely not really know what we were doing. And then eventually stumbled across something where people would pay us money for it. So we just said, let's do more of this thing and do it in as many places as possible.
Well, today I've got two guests on the show. Both are Army veterans, both were at West Point, and they are both brothers about 2 years apart at West Point. They have co-founded two different companies. Their first startup, Everblue, was in the energy space, and they had a successful exit on that. After they sold their first company, after about 4 years of running that, they went together to the Stanford Sloan School of Management, where they graduated a year later together, and at the end of that started their second and current startup, VersaMe. I found John and Chris because there's a 2006 Forbes article about the top 25 veteran-founded startups in America, of which they were named as one. And I think you'll really enjoy this episode. They're both very candid. It's very interesting to hear the differences in their skills and how they work together. So if you're thinking of starting a company with someone close to you or a family member, this is the episode for you. If you're just looking to start a company, this is a great episode. They talk about getting experience before they started their company. Or if you're just looking to hear a great story of two awesome vets who work together to do the impossible, sell a startup once, and it looks like they're well on their way to doing that a second time. So with that, let's dive in to my interview with John and Chris at VersaMe. Well, joining me today is John Boigiano in Menlo Park, California right now, and Chris Boigiano in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thanks for having us,
Justin.
So I wanted to give listeners a little bit of background on each of you, and you guys make it easy since you have similar backgrounds as brothers together. So first of all, John and Chris are co-founders of VersaMe, which leverages technology for large-scale impact to improve early childhood education and language development. They've raised $2.5 million in funding, and they've got a team of 16 right now. Both John and Chris went to West Point. John, after West Point, served for 5 years in the Army, most recently as an operations officer and battle captain, 1st Infantry Division, whereas Chris served for 5 years, most recently as operations officer, 7th Army Joint Multinational Training Command. They started together a company called Everblue, and then they started VersaMe together as well. And they also both attended Stanford University under the Sloan Fellowship. And for context for everyone, I came across John and Chris because in 2016, Forbes wrote an article entitled The Top 25 Veteran-Founded Startups in America, of which their company was listed as one of those. So John and Chris, first of all, anything to add or amend to that intro?
No, it sounds good to me. I'm looking forward to talking more about it throughout this interview.
Awesome. I always like to start off just learning about the starting point of your civilian career. And, for each of you, what led you to decide to transition away from the Army?
So this is John, and I'm older than Chris, so I transitioned out first. I was fortunate in the military that I had started just before 9/11. I graduated West Point in 2000, and I got to experience the Army before and after the transition. And the post 9/11 Army was much more innovative, in my opinion. The invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq were big events for the military that kind of shook off the bureaucratic shackles. I remember being at the range pre 9/11. You'd literally have to account for every round, and it was a very, very rigid affair. And then by the time you finish a deployment in Iraq, it was just completely different. The priorities and what mattered had changed quite a bit. But over my time, I was stationed in Germany for 5 years, a little over 5 years there, and it was pretty intense. I mean, it was a great period of my life. But between training and deployments, I was gone for a significant chunk of that 5 years. And I had gotten married while I was in Germany, and I wanted to have kids, and I started thinking about what the future would hold. And this was pre-surge. This was and literally the future looked like back-to-back deployments or every other year deployments, and in between doing lots of training in the military. And so that was when I made the decision to I decided I wanted to get out, and if I was going to get out and go in the civilian world, I wanted to do that. I didn't just want to get out. I wanted to have a plan. And so I basically attacked getting out and spent about a year and a half to 2 years preparing to get out. And so that was I still love the military. I still love my service. I'm still in the Army Reserves. But I mainly got out because of the op tempo, and I wanted to have a family life as well.
This is Chris. Obviously we have similar bios. I was just staggered behind John, being a couple years younger than him, with both when I graduated from West Point and when I went into the Army. But for me, it was a combination of op tempo in that I had 9/11 happened my senior year at West Point, or my first year. And so I graduated into an Army at war. And I then spent a little more than a couple years basically deployed back to back. And, you know, same kind of decisions with, not knowing if or when that would ever end. And here we are 15 years later, and it's still ongoing to some extent. But that uncertainty was one of the factors. Another was that, for better or worse, a lot of the what I thought were the most interesting and kind of forward-facing assignments are pretty early on in your career. So I was fortunate to be able to do some really awesome things. I feared that I could spend the rest of a career kind of trying to relive my first handful of years in the Army. And then my last thing is just the nature of a bureaucracy. I love the Army and it functions amazingly, but at the same time, as John had alluded to, that, you know, even in the best of times, it's still limited on how quickly the military can innovate, for good reason too. But I often would find myself frustrated why things were the way they were, or why they weren't, why they couldn't change faster, which is sort of what led to, you know, the career that I have today in the civilian world.
Yeah, I wanted to add a comment on that. One of the things I was also looking to get in the civilian world was a better meritocracy, at least early on in the Army. It didn't matter whether you're a competent officer or not. Everybody got promoted at the same time. Everybody got the same assignments, and there were little things. You might get a little bit longer platoon leader time, and you might get lucky and get a second platoon leader chance. But for the most part, everybody was on the same rigid marching orders, and there really wasn't much differentiation between good officers and bad officers. That was part of my frustration with the bureaucracy of just getting out, is that, and then the second piece of the bureaucracy is, because of the deployments, my timeline was messed up. And this is still an issue with the Army, where there's very strict timelines, where if you want to hit all the promotion blocks, there's certain tasks you have to do. You have to go to school right at the 3-year mark. You have to be a company commander by the 6-year mark. And I wanted to go teach. I wanted to go back to West Point to teach. And pretty much by the time we got back from Iraq, my timeline for being able to do that was shot. And I wouldn't be able to do that and still stay on a promotion track in the Army. And so that was also a part of the reason I got out, was the bureaucracy. And that's part of what led to us becoming entrepreneurs, is I didn't want to be in a bureaucracy. I want to control my own destiny.
And I always like to learn about that first job search. And, you know, John, you talked about spending that year and a half to 2 years before you got out, preparing for that transition. And Chris, I'm just guessing that John was at least some resource as you approached that transition point. What would you want listeners to know about that transition from Army life to civilian life, and any advice on how to prepare for that?
Sure. I got a couple thoughts on that. The first is it's sort of impossible to know what it's like on the other side of, you know, that line until you get there. You can do a lot of preparation, but to some extent, until you take the leap, you know, you can't really know until you do it yourself. But preparation certainly doesn't hurt, right? I think that the thing that changed that I didn't expect, I think that part of being in the Army is there's this binary expectation of you're either going to serve your time and get out or you're in for a career. But the expectation that I fell into was that when I left the Army, that the company that I went to, that I would be with them for an indefinite period of time, a really, really long period of time. Like I was looking at it in a kind of a decades long question. And then a year later, I was gone from that role and on to starting my first company. I think that had I gone in with the expectation that, well, I'm going to make the best decision that I can, and if I need to change course, then so be it. But I think at the time, as I was going through that, I felt a lot of guilt because I call the role that I went to when I left the Army the best bad decision I ever made. I picked a company that, for better or worse, just wasn't a good fit for me. It was still a good experience in that it taught me what it's like to work in a bigger company. And it taught me what I don't enjoy. And it led to John and I starting our first company together. In the long run, it ended up working out beautifully. But in the short term, I had quite a bit of guilt and stress in that kind of second transition from my first corporate job to my first startup.
For me, I spent a lot of time. A lot of that time was reading books. I went through a headhunter program called Cameron Brooks, and they had a whole book reading list that I devoured. And then I probably spoke to 20 or 25 people that had already made the transition and a couple of years ahead of me to find their advice. And I remember getting one of the pieces of advice that I got was that I should, when I leave the military, make a list of what my personal goals are and what's important to me, my values, and then dust that off, usually around tax season. And make sure that I am following and staying true to that. And so that was really valuable insight. It's when you get out, the Army does a good job of making sure you do things like get a health checkup and go to the dentist and stay physically fit. But when you get out, there's nobody telling you to do that. And so for me, maintaining my physical fitness, maintaining my mental health, going to the doctor, like I had this list of things that I was going to take care of no matter what. And then I also wanted to work for one of the things I didn't want was just a job. I wanted to go play someplace where I could have, I love the Army's work hard, play hard mentality. I love the fact that you can go all in on a deployment and then when you come back, you can take block leave and you're completely off. And so for me, knowing that environment was important to me shaped my job search. I didn't want just a job. I wanted to work with great people and I really wanted to be able to have someplace that I would enjoy working for and look forward to it.
You know, I have to own my own bias here. I'm very excited, to hear your story as two brothers working together. My brother was a year ahead of me at the Naval Academy, and it would be a dream to work together. And I'm just curious, what was the starting point of you guys forming a partnership? Was this something you thought growing up, or was this like, do you remember a particular conversation or turning point where you thought, let's do something together?
I don't think we'd ever thought growing up. Our father was a cop and our mom worked in the public school system. So entrepreneurship wasn't exactly in the blood. So I don't think that in that capacity, working together was something we had put a lot of thought to, but we had worked together both throughout school, long before West Point, through the years we were kind of, we'd be together for a couple of years, then apart, then back together. But when we were together in school, we'd work together. And then when we were in the Army, we were in the same brigade. So we deployed to Kosovo together. We deployed to Iraq together. We were kind of in the same unit. So there were we were working together pretty closely just in the military, moving to the same area. One of the things that I moved to Charlotte, I got job offers in a number of cities. I moved to Charlotte because John was located here, and he turned down a job opportunity somewhere else because I had just moved here. And so I think by being together, we had worked together in other capacities in the past. And then when we took the entrepreneurship plunge, it was a fairly natural transition to work together in that capacity. It was the entrepreneurship piece was the bigger shift for us, or at least for me personally.
Yeah, when Chris had moved to Charlotte, I think two events – We had always been, our father being, even though he was a police officer, always was doing little business things on the side. And so he was always a community activist. He always had side projects going on. And so we didn't start out necessarily wanting to be startup entrepreneurs trying to grow, you know, larger companies. We started out just looking at business ideas, and some of them were quite small scale when we started. But I think two events in my mind kind of stand out. One was I got out. I enjoyed my job, and I'll tell you a story of where that led to in a minute. And we made a very conscious decision to become entrepreneurs. But the second, the bigger thing was Chris, day one, when he got to the job that he had, was sitting in a cubicle. Day one, he came back and said, "This is not what I want to be doing." And so if his experience had been different, we might not have started a company. And so one was the day one, he just said, "This is not what I want to do. I need to be doing something else." And so that kind of, that spurred on kind of the, what my wife would call the idea of the week phase. Like, what else are we going to do? It was that soul searching and the research that led to us taking the plunge. And then the second thing that happened is actually, I had done really well at Carrier, the company I was working for. I was in sales, but I'd also gotten to operations and programming. I had done really, really well at the company. And my boss left to go to another company. And through that process, which is a really interesting story I'm happy to tell, but ultimately it came down to a decision that Chris and I made. Are we going to be entrepreneurs? And literally, I remember sitting at the table, and we came to the answer, yes. And from that moment forward, every decision we made was in that route, including quitting our jobs and including, setting our families up to say, hey, we're doing this. At that point, we had no idea how we were going to make money. But at that point, we were committed.
You know, I'd love to learn more about that decision-making process. And in particular, because both of you had experience after the Army before starting your own company. And I'm just picturing anyone on active duty who's listening who maybe aspires to start their own company. And I'm curious, one, if you could share your thoughts on whether or not that work experience was valuable, or whether you would recommend that prior to jumping into entrepreneurship. And then second of all, anything that was helpful as you guys sat across the table from each other, I'm picturing a table loaded down with beer, thinking about these tough questions about whether you're going to do this, anything that helped you gain clarity about if this was right for you or if this was something that was just not a good fit for you.
So to the first point, I think it was. For me, I learned the perspective I got working at Carrier. I worked in national accounts. Carrier had 100 and something offices, which was the same business model, just replicated in 100 locations. And just seeing how that worked, it was like, all you got to do is get something to work in one spot and you can replicate it. That fundamental idea, understanding finances, like cash flow, and like in the military, you're shielded from all of that. You have a budget, but you don't have to worry about cash balances. You don't have to worry about making payroll. There's a lot of things you just don't, there's a lot of just knowledge you don't have. And not that you can't learn it, but I think that having had the big corporate experience for me also colored, it also made it pretty clear that that's not what I wanted to do. I did not want to be middle management in a big company. It wasn't fulfilling enough. The employees weren't engaged enough. There wasn't enough of a mission there. And so it just made the decision to become entrepreneurs all the clearer. I couldn't imagine going back to sitting in a cubicle now. Like, just that's not who I am. But not having had that, I'd always be left wondering, what would that be like? Oh, it must be so easy to be a corporate person. And so for me, it was really invaluable to have that experience.
I would also say that the transition, you know, I did in short order, but I did make a transition from the Army to the civilian world, and then from the corporate world to being an entrepreneur. And I'm glad that they were staggered. So as much as the company that I went to, I knew pretty quickly that I wasn't going to last there. I still think it was a great experience for all the reasons John just highlighted. And then it gave me the time to transition to being a civilian. Like, my identity was wrapped up with, who I was so wrapped up with being a soldier that it allowed me to, you know, separate the two, mentally separate out those two parts of who I was. And then, in a more intentional manner, make the leap into becoming an entrepreneur in a little bit more of a deliberate way. I'm not saying that it wouldn't be possible. It would just be more painful and probably riskier to kind of just jump right from one into the other, I think.
Yeah, we joke about this all the time with recent veterans, like veterans that just got out. They're still militarized. They still, like, my wife calls it command voice. She'll tell me, like, when I first got out, she's like, I'm not one of your soldiers or my employees. And so there's a deep, like, you have to stop using acronyms. In a lot of cases, you have to stop cursing. You have to, like, there's all these things that the transition to the civilian world business acronyms, which for me, having read a slew of those books, it made the transition easier for me. And it takes time. It's hard. I mean, the military gets into your blood. And just the structure, like just there's so much of it there that it takes time to desensitize and to become a civilian and to be able to relate to civilians. So I think that the they need to plan for a transition period, and you can prep for it, but you still have to go through it. And there's also the identity thing of not having the team. I remember when we first moved to Charlotte, it took a little while. It took a couple of years for us to really form a community of people that when you live, especially living in Europe on the military base, my work, like people I worked with were also people I hung out with on the weekends. We'd go on trips, we'd go out drinking and do things. And so you kind of had this forced community in the military, the work hard, play hard. And when you get in the civilian world, you're not automatically going to be friends with your neighbors. You may have nothing in common with them. And that takes time to also transition to, is finding a purpose and finding that community.
This is great. And so what, as you guys were just asking each other these tough questions, it sounds like each of your work experience gave you a certain amount of comfort of like, I don't want this. I don't want to be part of a large organization. How did you guys challenge each other or tease out whether startups would be, starting your own company would be right versus maybe joining a startup or joining a smaller company? Like, how did you know this was the right fit for you?
I think for me, it was a process of elimination. I knew, if I looked at my peers in this, 6 or 12 months of kind of figuring out what I'm going to do with my life, that, most people go through when they're leaving the military in different capacities. Most of my peers went to graduate school at an MBA or a law program, something like that. They went to work at a big corporation like I did. And then someone to work for other federal agencies, the FBI or the State Department or so forth. But those are kind of the three main routes. And I looked at all three of those and said, well, I don't think I want to do any of those. And I didn't want to go back in the Army. So it was a process of elimination. I didn't know, I can't tell whether I've changed or the world has changed, but I didn't know any startup lingo when I started this. I didn't know what revenue meant. I didn't know what the term, I didn't know what a brand was. I didn't know what a venture capitalist was. They were words that I'd heard, but I couldn't define them or explain to anyone else what any of that meant. So it was a process of elimination. And then, getting out, just my personality, I probably had more of a chip on my shoulder than John. So I was more aggressive about once I decided I wanted to do something, kind of just going after it a little bit. I think that the biggest thing that the military helped me with was, as John had said, working for something that I cared about. So the thought process initially was, well, we're in Iraq. Kind of wish we weren't in Iraq. We're probably in Iraq because Iraq sits on top of a bunch of oil. If Iraq didn't sit on top of a bunch of oil, we probably wouldn't care very much about what goes on in Iraq, and Iraq wouldn't be able to bother us all that much. Wouldn't it be great if our country didn't have to care about Iraq's oil or the Middle East's oil? Maybe we should start an energy-related business. Okay, let's go figure that out. And that was roughly the thought process that kind of gave us the left and right limits of let's start an energy business. And then we just explored a million different, as John said before, the idea of the week, we just endlessly turned over, rock after rock after rock trying to find something. Absolutely not really know what we were doing. And then eventually stumbled across something where people would pay us money for it. So we just said, let's do more of this thing and do it in as many places as possible. And that's what became our first business. But it wasn't, it's hard to overstate how little we knew about business or any of that without being motivated to just kind of figure problems out as they came to us, or at least for me. Yeah. John had a little bit more experience in the corporate world, so some of that might not apply to him, but that's certainly how I felt.
Yeah, my advice for anybody transitioning is to be deliberate. Most people, people in the military are usually drivers. They go after what they want. They have to accomplish the mission, the objective. So just be deliberate about what it is you're trying to accomplish. And for me, transition from the Army to the business world was still very bureaucratic, especially if you're not at the top of the business world. It's very restrictive. So I wanted to control my own destiny. We have a family reunion in August, and I wanted to be able to make that. I wanted to set my own. I want to be able to choose when I take vacation because family was important to me. That was why I left the military. So working for a company where I couldn't choose that was unacceptable to me. So controlling my own destiny was one. The second thing is I like building things. I like making things, whether it's product or teams or companies. I like creating things, and I wanted to have more ownership in it. And I knew that about myself. And then the third thing is I wanted a bigger purpose. And so all of the companies that we've either seeded or created are what we call social mission companies. Not only are we trying to make money and build something, but we're also trying to make the world a better place. And so for me, those were the kind of the fundamental assumptions that I had determined when I left the military that I wanted to do or accomplish over my career. And that helped guide us towards entrepreneurship. So when Chris and I were sitting down, I think it was a Thursday evening, it was like, are we going to go do these civilian jobs? Because we had some outstanding promotions, or are we going to do the startup thing? And it made it easier to choose the startup route.
And, you know, so you have this idea around energy. I want to get into your current startup, but for your first startup, what was that process like? Is that something you're still running on the side? And kind of how did that help you get to your second startup?
So first off, we wound up selling that business. We grew it sizable enough, and we got it to a point where it became very attractive to what's called large strategic companies, big companies. And so we wound up selling that business after about 4 years. The way I would liken it is we chose a problem that we wanted to focus on, and then from there, at least in the Army, it's called a movement to contact. You know there's enemy out there somewhere. You need to go find them and develop the battlefield, develop the intelligence around it. And so the idea of the weak phase was talking to every expert we could, getting as much information as we could. And just in that process, we ourselves had become such knowledgeable experts in the field. Well, that took about 2 years. And throughout that process, that led us to become experts. And then people said, oh, well, if you could solve this problem, I'll pay you for that. And ultimately, that's how we wound up starting the business. But without the 2 years of turning over the rocks, it would have been really difficult for us to really successfully start the business. Most people think the business is about the idea. You know, I need to have a really good idea. I don't think it's about the idea. I think it's about the problem you're solving. And then the ideas will come out of the problem if you're passionate about solving the problem. Because you can't – the cool thing about entrepreneurship is if it was really, really obvious how to solve the problem, it's probably already been done. And so you're looking for the angle that nobody else has figured out yet.
Sorry, just giving room there. No, I think that's awesome. And I love hearing that process. And, you know, first of all, congratulations on the exit. I think that's incredible. And I hope your advice for people listening is empowering in that you don't need to have an idea. You don't need to have this killer product. You just need to have curiosity, a lot of motivation and drive, and a willingness to continuously learn and uncover, you know, aspects of that problem. I'm wondering during that 2 years until you found that idea, how did you guys survive? Like, did you have savings built up, or how were you able to keep things going for the 24 months it took to actually identify a problem you could monetize?
So I'll let Chris answer that just in a second. But Chris, basically, we did a lot of the research while we worked at the other companies. But then I give Chris credit because once we made the decision we were going to be entrepreneurs, he burned the bridge. He quit his job and he said, I've got 3 or 6 months of savings and we need to make money. Let's figure it out. And I challenge anybody, if I said to you, anybody especially in the military, if I said in the next year, you need to figure out how to at least replace your salary, I think anybody in the military can do that. You kind of got to burn the bridge behind you. And I give Chris credit because he was the first to burn the bridge. Chris, do you want to add color to that?
My logic on it, it was really scary to think, again, entrepreneurship not entirely being in our blood, it was really scary to think about just taking that leap. And the exercise that was most helpful to me was, you know, I had gotten out of the Army and bought a house and I had a mortgage, and mortgage rates were a lot higher than they are today. So the mortgage was a lot higher than it would be today. And my wife had just a gazillion dollars in student loan debt and, you know, all this stuff. And I get out and I'm, you know, it was financially, even being in the corporate sector, there were a lot of things that I suddenly had to pay for, the gym membership, healthcare, all these things that you kind of get for free that, um, I, I you know, they made it financially stressful in the civilian world to have to worry about paying all those bills. So then there's this fear of what happens if I can't pay the bills? I've only got so much savings to do that. And the thing that liberated me from that was going through an exercise of thinking, well, what happens if I don't pay those bills? So it was just my wife and I at the time. She had moved to North Carolina from New Jersey when she finished graduate school, right in line with when I got out of the Army, and she couldn't get a job. So the day I quit, she was working for $8 an hour at Barnes & Noble. So our household income was in the range of, you know, $15,000 or $20,000 a year. And we had a mortgage and student loans and all that other stuff I just described. And I said to myself, you know, what happens if I can't pay the mortgage? Like, let's say I burn through all my savings. Everything goes to, I come to the end of this time. And if I don't pay the mortgage and the bank takes my house. And then I said, you know what? We'll just move back in with our parents. We'll, suck it up and we'll go get a job again. We'll figure it out. But we've got a family and a support network that would help us through that. And for me, it was liberating to think, wow, it's really not that bad. I'm not saying it would be a pleasant experience, but having been to Iraq and seen people's lives in complete ruins, in every way imaginable, but quite literally in ruins, to me, it was like, well, it's really not that scary now that I've kind of thought it through. And that's what gave me the, I just said, this is the life I want to live. I'm going to go after it. And then I just went after it. And the other thing, we had started out wanting to, or in the energy kind of movement to contact that John had described, when we started out, we thought we were going to do energy audits on homes. There's all this construction going on. It's before the financial crisis. And so we started out as an energy auditing business, and we had lined up hundreds or even thousands of homes worth of work. And along the way, we had to get trained on that, and the training was horrible. And so we said, we can do better training than this. We did training in the military. And so we, John threw up on Google AdWords we had a one-page website that offered training, and people started to call to ask for that training. And that's how we, over the course of a couple of months, shifted from an energy auditing business to a training business that, that we, over the next year or two grew to be, have 100 or so locations around the country and around the world. So even after we had, quote unquote, started the business, we did quite a big shift. At the time we debated trying to keep both, but the biggest thing was we realized there was more money in one bucket than the other. So we went after the bigger bucket.
And yeah. Our third partner at the time was very big into focus. You can only really do one or two things well. So you got to be very explicit about what you focus on. The biggest risk in a startup is distraction, trying to do too many things.
And we had no idea at the time, but a few months later, the whole housing crisis and all the work that we had lined up on the auditing side would go away. Even if we had tried to keep it, but at that point, we had walked away from all of it. But, I don't know if any of this would have been possible without things like Google advertising and, some kind of internet-based advertising where you can turn on ads in 50 states or in a, specific municipality. So the ability to ramp up advertising quickly allowed us to kind of stamp out a new location as quickly as we could think them up. It was literally a question of going to the map and saying, what other cities can we add here? Where can we turn on Google? And then once we did that, that kind of led to more training and so on and so forth. So the advent of that type of online advertising, had we tried the same business 10 years before, I'm not sure it would have worked without, or would have been from a marketing standpoint, would have been fundamentally different.
I mean, I love the courage in that story of taking that leap. I love that process of just really imagining the worst case scenario and realizing that in particular, in contrast to the military, it's not that extreme. It's not that awful. And, even that said, I still think it takes a tremendous amount of courage and commitment to make that plunge. And I also love that example of using low cost experiments through Google AdWords to actually test out an idea and see that there's actually demand there, and then going where that data leads you. I think that's a really cool way to, just throw things out there and see where the interest is from the market and see where people are actually willing to pay, and then building the business in that direction. I want to get into Versamy, but I'm just curious, before we get there, where does Stanford's Sloan School come into play? Was that while you were at Everblue, or was that while you were at Versamy?
In between. So okay. We sold Everblue, and then we left in 2012. And we went to Stanford. I didn't want to go to graduate school at all for the same reasons I didn't want to go when I got out of the Army. So John eventually nagged me, and we applied together. I think the deadline was like January 12th, and he convinced me on New Year's Day. So in about a 10-day period, I took the GMAT and wrote essays and got recommendations and the whole nine yards, and we applied together. And it was potentially the most flippant application to Stanford ever because I didn't entirely want to go. So I was pretty truthful about, you know, what my expectations were or why I was interested in the program or why I would consider it. But when we interviewed, they asked us together, what happens if we only accept one of you? And before John could answer, I said, well, you take both of us or take neither of us. We're a package deal. And it worked out, and I'm super glad that I went there. But that was where Versamy came from. We kind of did Stanford in between. And John, as much as I'm maybe the riskier or bigger risk taker of the two brothers, John is potentially more thoughtful than me. So it balances itself out sometimes. And I'm really lucky that we were able to go and have that opportunity because it was one of the best experiences of my life.
John, what led you to, like, why did you champion that? So I'm picturing, you know, you have this epic success behind you of your first startup. You have an exit, which is so rare. And then I imagine you're kind of tossing around what to do next, whether to start something, whether to just coast for a while. What made you think that going to grad school was the right call at that point?
Well, two things. First, even though we had an epic success, we were absolutely intent on starting another business. And we wanted to do bigger and better. But we still felt like amateurs. Even though we had started and sold the business, we never had any formal training in business. The military is all about leadership, so is West Point and engineering, but there's no business application of that. And so I wanted to address what I perceived to be our weaknesses, number one. Number two, we had just made a lot of money on Everblue, and Stanford was an adventure. Come out here to the center of entrepreneurship, the center of startup life, center of technology, and basically make, like, that was the reward for having the stress of Everblue. And we worked our butts off at Everblue, and coming out to Stanford for a one-year program was the reward. And so it wasn't necessarily grad school in and of itself, but it was the experience of doing something different. And then also there was by that point we had lived in North Carolina the longest. When I was in the military, I think I moved between the military and right afterwards and moved 7 times in 10 years. And then all of a sudden I got to North Carolina, bought a house, and I hadn't moved in about as long, about, you know, in about 7 years, 7 or 8 years. And so it was like, I was feeling the itch to do something new. And coming out to Stanford for a year was a great way to satisfy that itch.
And what was that, while you're at Sloan, what was that genesis that became Versamy?
So when we had Everblue, we kind of straddled two industries. We straddled energy and education and retraining, like workforce training. And so when we sold Everblue, we kind of had expertise in two domains. And so when we went to Stanford, we said, okay, we want to go deeper into one of them. Energy is making a lot of progress. Like renewable energy is it's amazing how far it's come. And our whole pitch at Everblue that it's in our national security interest, like that was really taking off, and it still is. Like when you go to center of Texas, you know, which is big oil country, and you're saying it's our national security interest to do renewable energy, like that, we're winning that argument. Despite the politics of today, like renewable energy prices are dropping. So that feels like that problem's on the mend. But when it came to education, we struggled with the technology, we struggled with the tool sets. And to be frank, like we were doing training of unions, retraining steel workers that were laid off. We were retraining prisoners. It just felt like the impact that we could have on education was so much greater. And so we basically went on this research project of what is innovative in education. Literally, if it's considered innovation in education and involves technology, we spoke to them, we toured the school, we again turned over every rock in education. And ultimately, just near the end of Stanford, we were about to walk away and say, you know what, education is an in-person business, and there's really not much, like there are neat things like Khan Academy and that type of stuff, but nothing that's absolutely moving the needle that you can point to. MOOCs were big at the time, like Udacity, Coursera, and so on, but they've kind of faded a little bit. Until we came, Chris read an article in the New York Times and about a lab at Stanford that we didn't even know about. And that lab basically was an early education, it was an infant learning lab. Because everything we had looked at for education was kindergarten on up. And we went and visited that lab. And she was so excited that somebody was taking an interest in her work. And really her whole thesis and the whole thesis of all that research is that if you really want to impact education and brain speed and a lot of the life outcomes, you need to start at birth and you need to do it before kindergarten. If you wait to kindergarten, it's too late. And that was the genesis behind starting Versity and building the Starlight.
How would you describe, for especially for someone on active duty, how would you describe Versamy and what you guys do right now?
So that's a good question. So for somebody on active duty, we're envisioning reimagining education, and not education in a classroom, but education at home, and we're giving parents the tools, and we're helping them implement what the research says is the ways to the methods to raise brilliant, happy, successful children. And if you want to do that, you need to start at birth, and we will help you do that through the tools and the technologies that we're building. And that's basically the pitch for it, is that for parents that really want to give their kids a competitive edge and help them be successful in life, we can help you do that. But you need to start at birth.
And what has been, you've been going for a couple of years now, what has been one of the biggest challenges so far?
First, our biggest change in perspective has been that the biggest people in need of help are the agencies and the medical community. Like, the education and health really blends together at a very early age. So a lot of the tools we're building are to help the therapists, the doctors, the teachers, the nurses, the caregivers that surround a family, to help them do their jobs better. That's how the Starling is, and we've just spent the last 7 months building a new system to help them do that. The biggest challenge that we have is we're trying to change mindsets. You know, most parents don't think of education or don't think of their child's brain development when they're born. They worry about safety and they worry about the basics, like, are they gaining weight? But they don't think that, education doesn't, they don't even start thinking about that until they have to think about kindergarten or preschool. So there are certain cultures out there, certain subset cultures in the U.S. that do believe that. And they're relatively easy wins. But our goal is to get the vast majority of America to really have a mindset change that every parent is qualified to be their child's first teacher. Because there's a bunch of these biases out there that, I'm not a teacher, that the teacher will take care of the education piece. So parents have this lack of confidence about their own capabilities. And so it's more cultural hurdles than anything else.
We have another way to put that is that most people don't remember the first few years of their life. Your memory of early childhood, even pretty deep into early childhood, is spotty for most people. And so as an adult looking back, you kind of feel like you're as smart as you are and you were just born that way, right? Because you don't remember being a 6 month old and your parent interacting with you. That part of your life is just erased from your memory. And so people are far more likely to attribute intelligence to genetics than environmental factors. So in the nature versus nurture debate, it's entirely intuitive to just feel like you were born the way you are, and that's as smart as you're going to be, and that's it. But what the research suggests is that it's quite the opposite, and parents can have a massive amount of impact on their child's success in life. So while parents, if you asked a parent of a newborn, would you want your child to go to Stanford? I would guess most parents would say yes, or a school like Stanford. They would love for their child to go to college and go to a great college and
on a scholarship.
Yeah, exactly. All the great things that come with that. But they feel like that on the intelligence side of things, that it's beyond their ability to kind of do anything about it. And then there's education, which is mostly focused on delivering content, and based on whatever your level of intelligence is, teaching you how to do things with that intelligence. And then again, parents, they overestimate the impact of school on a child's success and underestimate the impact that they have, even though a child typically, even a school-age child, only spends maybe 20% of their hours in a year in a school setting, even if they're in school. So the vast majority of a child's time is, with their parents. And so parents do themselves a disservice on those two fronts by attributing genetics to intelligence and then assuming that they don't have an impact on what their child learns. And then the dots are disconnected, so you kind of wake up with a teenager and you say, oh, he or she is capable of going to this level of school or maybe not capable of going to college at all. And parents feel at that point like it's just a thing that's been, fate has been set and there's only kind of so much they can do. But the reality is that you know, there's a ton of you know, up and down movement in the first months and years of a child's life that parents give no credit to, by and large.
So I'm just conscious we've got about 10 minutes left, and there's like 100 different questions I'd ask. So I might actually turn things over to you. I mean, part of me is curious about what it's like to work together as siblings and advice you'd have for veterans thinking of working with family. Part of me is curious about your experience in fundraising or just your advice on startups in general. Part of me wants to ask about the acquisition process and advice on that. And I know that you guys probably talk to so many different veterans and so many different people. I'd love to just maybe give you guys a little bit more leeway to, you know, get on your soapbox and share whatever you think would be most helpful to a veteran who's thinking of starting their own company.
So I can address the first one. Well, kind of the first two. Research would say that starting a business with a family member makes it more likely that you would fail, because you're often unwilling to have tough conversations with a family member. And so a little problem can become a big problem, because people will, in a well-intended way to protect a relationship, they'll never have a difficult conversation, and little problems become big ones, and the business fails as a result. So whether it be a family member, a sibling, or a spouse, or whoever, I think the most important thing with a business partner is, one, you should have one. It's much more fun when you're in it with someone else. And two, you should be able to have a good fight and not really hold a grudge after the fact. So John and I fight like two little old ladies all the time. Our employees always laugh at us about the things we fight over. But it never sticks. It's never like there's a grudge or anything like that. So we can have our disagreements, and then it's just whatever. It's no big deal. I don't know how we ended up that way, but I could tell you that if I wasn't in business with my brother, that's kind of the quality that I would be looking for, you know, in someone else. So I don't know if you have anything you wanted to say there, John.
Yeah, I would add that whether it's siblings or others, the most important ingredient to a successful business is the partners, your partners in the support network. I do think it's essential that a business has partners, because your energy levels and your momentum, like it's just more fun with other people, and you're more likely to survive. When you're feeling down, the other person can like take the ball. You can, like, if all the stress is on one person's shoulders, it can grate on you.
You're more likely to raise money. A lot of investors won't invest in solo founder companies.
Solo founder, yep.
Because you're more likely to quit when your motivation is down. Whereas if you have someone else to kind of pull you through it, or someone else who's depending on you, you're more likely to stick it out. So despite the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world, from a statistical standpoint, they're more of an anomaly than most businesses are going to be successful with probably two partners, maybe three. And then beyond that, the other side, it becomes too many people to manage. But it's just more fun when you have other people to kind of be in it with you.
And I would also recommend that anybody who's thinking about this, whether it's entrepreneurship or whether it's going to the business world from the military, Defense Secretary Mattis, I mean, he says that leaders need to be learners. Like he's a very big believer that you need to be reading, you need to be learning constantly. And I believe that's true no matter what you're doing. When we started this company, Versamo, with the Starling, we knew nothing about hardware. We weren't that good at scaling software, but we've learned and we've attacked that learning aspect. We thought that was going to be our biggest risk, was building the physical product. It turned out that actually we did. We've done really well with that. With a cohort of startups that came out of Stanford with us, I think we're the only ones so far to actually ship a product. It turns out that the marketing has been a little bit tougher, but for the most part, you got to attack what you don't know, and you got to ask people for advice. I'd say coming out of the military, that's one of the other things that people, and this is not just special to the military, but in general, people are afraid to ask for help or advice. And I've gotten over that in my experiences. People are more than willing to give advice, and people are more than willing to help a veteran, but you got to ask for it. And it could be a cold email, it could be a cold call, but just ask people for their knowledge, and people are more than happy to share their knowledge, but you got to ask for it.
Is, you talked about that learning component. I think that's such a great quote that you shared from General Mattis. Is there any resources that could be books, that could be webinars, that could be anything that's just really helped you in your civilian career that you would want to share to veteran listeners?
Google is pretty much anything you could learn using Google.
Yep. For me, and there was a series of books, but Google is a great tool. Google is a learning engine. It's the best form of online learning. But I would recommend reading some career advice books. There's some that are written specifically for the military. Because if you're a big believer in the mission of the military, one of the things that struck me when I was doing the reading was how important the business community is to the strength of the United States. Like, if you believe the military is the strongest part of the United States, I don't believe that. I actually think our economy and the businesses that we build and the innovation that we bring to the world is what makes us so strong. And that enables us to pay for a good military. So to me, the work we do in the business world is a part of what West Point calls the lifetime of service to the nation. And so I wouldn't just read technical books. I would read books that frame business and innovation in the sense of a mission. I'm reading Elon Musk's book right now, the biography of him, and he's on a mission to change the world. So I would read inspiring biographies, I would read career advice books, and I would read books about finding your purpose and mission, because once you have that core set of values and you acknowledge them and you write them down, that can be a very powerful driver. And then you can go learn any technical skills or any financial skills that you might need.
I just read that Elon Musk biography. I thought it was so inspiring. So incredible, too, to see someone who's been so successful and just continuously facing challenges and just overcoming adversity. And it's never an easy road, even when you're in that billionaire realm. So I thought that was a great read as well.
One of the other lessons I think that we learned is when we started Everblue, I always had this mindset that next month or in 3 months, when we get over this hurdle, life will be good. Like, life will be perfect. The reality is that not once during any business that I've had since leaving the military have I ever felt like I was anything other than on the cliff's edge. Like, one wrong step and we might go over the edge. And so I've just learned to live with that onset, like that fact, and just realize that that's normal. That fear of failure never really goes away, and you just have to kind of accept it and there's a drive for it. And then the other thing is that dealing with a team, very few times, there's always some type of personal issue on a team. And I used to think, oh, if I just solve this one issue, like, my team will be perfect. And the reality is that what I used to think of, like, as a distraction to my business has now turned out to be, like, the core of my job is keeping the team performing. I've just come to accept that those don't change. Like, those are two norms that you're never going to feel successful. Whether you're Elon Musk and a billionaire, or whether you're just starting out and you've just made your first dollar bill, you have the same stress and fear of failure in life.
Well, this is great. Well, I was just taking notes on that. I think that's so great, though, that thought, that realization, too, because I struggle with that as well, where you think that there's some pinnacle where everything's easy and problems are behind you. And I think it's just sinking in now. I'm like, what, 37? I'm like, it's just, this is what life is. There's just nonstop challenges. And I think that the moment the challenges stop is when you get bored and you lack a purpose. So it's like shifting that mindset to realize that these challenges are, that's what life is. That's inevitable as long as you're moving forward.
That's very well said. It's if you ask Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos or any other successful, I guarantee they're stressed. It doesn't go away between the smallest startup and the biggest successful public company. You're always wondering what's going to come tomorrow. What are you not thinking about? What could cause you kind of to head the other way?
Awesome. Well, I know we've only just scratched the surface here, but I appreciate both of your perspectives. And for listeners, you can look at beyonduniform.io for show notes of everything we talked about. You can also find their startup, VersaMe, at versame.com. I'll have links to that in the show notes as well. John and Chris, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks. Thank you, Justin. Yeah. Really appreciate it.
Surface.
All right, Beyond the Uniform listeners, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. A couple quick asks. If you enjoy the show, sign up for our newsletter at beyonduniform.io. I send out a newsletter each week with the show notes and information about the interview. Also, if you could give us a great review on iTunes, it takes about a minute or two, but it really helps build awareness about Beyond the Uniform. And then lastly, if you like audiobooks, check out a free trial with audible.com at beyonduniform.io/books. You get a free ebook, no strings attached, a free audiobook, no strings attached. And I get a little bit of money to help offset the cost of the show, which is about $75 a month right now. Thanks. Have a great week. And I'll be back next week with more stories from veterans about their civilian career.